Welcome into the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. You know, folks, I was putting together shows not too long ago, a week or two ago, got an email that absolutely, no pun intended, stoked my interest like there is no tomorrow. I saw that there's a brand new project out there, and you know, it's from a good friend of ours, an old friend of ours. Dacre Stoker is out there, and he has a brand new project having to do with Dracula. Now, we had him on the program previously with Chris McCauley, and they had some other projects going on with Dracula. And this time around, there's a brand new documentary film that he's putting together with Irish filmmaker Jason Figgis, and it's being written by John West. And when I saw this, I absolutely popped. I went, wow, okay, all right, here we go. Because, you know, Hollywood recently came out with a film loosely based on, we'll talk about it with Dacre, about just a sliver of the Dracula novel. They took just a slight sliver of it. It was just Dracula's voyage on the ship, and they took and tried to make a whole movie out of it. Well, it was okay. I just thought it was okay. We'll get Dacre's take on it and what he thought of it. I know he went to the premiere, and we'll talk about that right away here in the beginning. But now here we're going to get Bram Stoker's life story in a brand new documentary, and we'll tell you how you can get involved with it. It's an exciting show today, folks. Let's jump into it right away, shall we? First, let's tell you a little bit about Dacre. If you don't remember from the last time, he's the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker and the international best-selling co-author of Dracula the Undead, the official Stoker family-endorsed sequel to Dracula. Dacre is also the co-editor with Elizabeth Miller of the Lost Journal of Bram Stoker, The Dublin Years. His latest novel, Dracul, is a prequel to Dracula. It was released in October of 2018 and was co-authored with J.D. Barker and has been sold to Putnam in North America, Penguin Random House in the UK, and additional publishers in France, Spain, Italy, Hungary, Brazil, Serbia, Taiwan, Turkey, Vietnam, Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Portugal, and Poland, with film rights purchased by Paramount Studios. He's a native of Montreal, Canada. Dacre taught physical education and sciences for 22 years in both Canada and the U.S. and has participated in the sports of modern pentathlon, there we go, as an athlete and a coach at the international and Olympic levels in Canada for 12 years. He's also an avid player and coach of the unique game of real tennis. In May of 2016, as an athlete, he had been coaching for the past 4 years. Let's bring him into the program right now. Let's talk some Dracula. Ladies and gentlemen, let's bring back to Darkness Radio, Dacre Stoker. How you doing, sir?
Hey, Tim, great to be here. Always good to be on the dark side, especially with you.
It's a pleasure to have you back, my friend. The last time I saw you, I believe, was Michigan Paracon, just in passing. We were both so busy, but it was good to see you just for the brief time. I got to ask you.
I'm coming back this summer.
As am I. I'll be back for...
Awesome. Yeah. You know, I know that Brad doesn't want to wear out everyone's welcome and get everybody, you know, Dacre fatigue or whatever. But I was so excited. You know, he said, look, we're just going to kind of space this out. And have you got something new and different? And so, yeah, I'm bringing some new stuff. But yeah, it'll be cool to see. We're going to have to sit down and chat about more things in the world of darkness, Tim, while we're up there.
It sounds like you have something new here. You've got this new documentary. And that you're working on. Before we jump into that, though, Dacre, I want to, and the name of the movie is, I'm sorry, escaping me.
The Last Voyage of the Demeter.
There you go. That's what it is.
So, no, you're absolutely right. It was based on a sliver. Apparently, this particular movie was a long time in the making. Okay. I know that a fellow actually did a comic book on it. Mm-hmm. The script was actually made by somebody else. And it, as for the readers, chapter 7 in Dracula, you get little bits and pieces. And it was written this way to create this great mystique of what the heck is going on in the Demeter, as Dracula obviously has his minions. The gypsies load up 50 boxes of dirt so he could bring all of his native soil with him. He's in there somewhere, and the ship has to make its way off to Whitby. and weird stuff happens because as the ship log is discovered, as this thing has wrecked in Whitby at the very end of the chapter, end of the novel, as the authorities piece together things, they begin to realize that a log was found, an addendum to the log was found. The only guy alive is the captain whose hands were lashed to the wheel, and he managed to bring the ship in to the Whitby Harbor. Now, in just a flashback to Bram Stoker's real life situation, when he was in Whitby in the summer of 1890, he actually saw a report of the very same ship, but called the Dimitri, not the Demeter, came into the harbor in weird conditions. The crew of Russian sailors, it really did come from Varna, as the fictional one did too, were all drunk and underneath the decks because they were scared to death of making it through the treacherous Whitby reefs, and managed to get into the narrow piers where the water was calm, and wrecked on the shore. So based on reality, Bram did, and this story based loosely on what happened in the novel, which is not much. So it gave the screenwriters and the director a lot of room, but also, problems, because you've got this great novel that has a reference to this whole thing. How do you make some great tension and a whole plot when there's not much there in the book? So obviously that hasn't stopped people in the past, because they've made up whole stories about Dracula, ignoring the book. But sure, this one I felt was fairly faithful to what was left behind, at least the two crew members named in the book were named in the actual film. They added something different, like they added a female, which you have to have in movies nowadays. That really didn't happen in the novel. Mm-hmm. But what I liked about it, Tim, and just to kind of wrap this up on this part, is for all the viewers that are horror fans, probably 80% would have, at least if they hadn't read the novel, had a pretty good idea of the novel. So you're working against an audience who supposedly knows the end of your movie.
Yeah.
That the ship wrecks in Whitby, nobody's there, and Count Dracula obviously doesn't die because he's there for the other 20 chapters of the book. So what happens? How does he get off? So they have to create all sorts of tension. And I felt that they did in this sort of claustrophobic feel with all the creaking and stuff going on, and the Dracula creature, who was really a badass creature, really looking much more like Count Orlok than Christopher Lee or even Bela Lugosi. And to that end, I liked it for that reason. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it could have had, there's enough jump scares, but maybe it could have had a little more developed plot or developed the characters more. But I was quite happy with it. I've seen so many Dracula films that were sort of kind of, maybe okay. But at least this one, if I was to be involved, and I've told this to many people, and yes, I was at a premiere, but Augusta, Georgia premiere, not California. But remember, this was during the writer's strike.
Right.
So there was no actors or anyone from SCAG allowed to be involved in it. So that's why they asked me to get, 20 of my best Dracula fans together to view it and then talk about it in social media and to print. And, I felt it was pretty good. And as I said, if I was to do Dracula as a streamed series and break down the book, that I would have left an awful lot of that in chapter 7 as one episode. So that's I got some thumbs up for that one. It's a good effort. The only weird thing is, Tim, mm-hmm. it was released in August. I really felt like if they want the vibe of a horror movie, I mean, you're a horror guy. Mm-hmm. Are you going to get really excited in August as opposed to, at least later September, October, November? So anyway, that's my take on it. Did you see it yourself or hear anything about it?
I heard a lot about it. I've seen on a screener, I saw maybe the first 20 minutes or so. I didn't have a lot of time to check it out, and I didn't never got back to it, to be honest with you. So I haven't seen much of it. But what I saw, I liked. Unfortunately, I never did get back to it, and that was my fault. It was one of those things where I got too busy to watch it. But to me, it moved
it's
a little
still out
slow.
There. I mean, look, it's out there on one of the streaming networks. Sure. I can't remember which one. So it's there if you want to go back.
See,
incidentally, I was off to Romania in November mm-hmm. to do a film festival where a project I was working on, a real just sort of a basic, what do you call it when you're doing a proof of concept documentary,
okay,
was being shown there, that was about my search for Castle Dracula.
Okay.
So it's not the documentary we're talking about here on the Indiegogo campaign. It was Romania based, how I actually found the location that Bram left in his notes. And I was showing that at the film festival. They were actually showing the Demeter, the Voyage of the Demeter, and asked me to introduce it and asked me to answer questions at the end. So I feel that, you know, the filmmakers kind of owe me a favor. I'm busting my butt to help promote this thing, which apparently is not doing as well as they'd hoped in the box office, and maybe it'll pick up viewership. But it really is a good, to me, old-fashioned horror film. You know, it has the right amount of violence, the right amount of jump scares, no gratuitous sex, mm-hmm. but it was still good. And so if you get a chance, Dacre said, watch it.
I think I will. I think the reason why I didn't go back to it is because I did hear that it was pretty faithful to the source material. So I was kind of like, well, I know what the source material is, so I don't know that I need to go back to it. But now that you've said this, I'll go back and I'll watch it, of course. As far as your other point as to, when you release horror movies these days, the new Omen prequel just came out, and I'm hearing from other, of course, the movie company didn't allow us regionally here to see a preview, which is unusual. Normally, when they don't allow you to see a preview, it's not a very good movie. But I'm hearing from the people who did get a chance to see it, the very few who got a chance to see it, that they think it's better than the original.
Oh, really? That's exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? That one scared the bejesus out of me, right. I'm telling you.
Right.
That was one of the first really scary ones.
Right. So to me, that says, and I think the reviewer from BuzzFeed said that's pretty impressive considering it's a Disney film.
yeah.
Right. So to me, and that coming out in April, why would you release The Omen in April consider this, Dacre, this year there is a 6/6/24. They could have waited till June and released it on 6/6/24, which would have been 6/6/6.
Yeah.
And they blew that one. So,
you think that somebody in charge either blew it or has a really good reason why not to? And who knows? It's maybe just over our head. I'm not in the filmmaking business. We're trying our hand at this documentary, which we'll get to in a while. But the big time stuff. That's a whole nother machine. I know a few people in the biz, but that's something else.
Well, we can get to the documentary now. I mean, we're here to do that piece of business now. I tell you, when I saw that you're reaching out because you want to. Of course, we're here to do that piece of business here and talk about this new documentary that you are putting together. I'm excited because, we talk about how to get a story out there. And it's funny that you're on this week because I had a conversation with Robert Dugoni, who has a book out called A Killing on the Hill. And it takes place in the Depression era. And one of the things we were talking about this week was getting a legacy story out there and maintaining a story of a legacy past a couple of generations. And how do you keep someone's legacy or name out there? Because it seems like even though someone may be much like your great-great-uncle, Bram Stoker, and when you say Bram Stoker, that's a name. That's a name that has weight. You say Bram Stoker, automatically you say Dracula. And you know that name carries weight, right? That name will span generations. But when Robert and I were talking this week, we said, for reference here, and I'll give you this reference here, Dacre, we were talking about how many trials of the century have we had? And he brought up O.J. Simpson. He said, how long will it be with O.J. Simpson before we forget the name O.J. Right. Simpson?
Yeah.
This trial that he covered, in Seattle was supposed to be the trial of the century with this killing of this boxer, Frankie Ray. It was 100 years ago. Nobody remembers this trial. So, you know, it's funny how time slips away and it also takes names with it.
Well, it does. And I think when you analyze, or at least when I analyze reactions to Bram Stoker, the obvious bigger reaction is to his creation. Mm-hmm. And so much energy, effort, money, creativity has gone into reimagining this classic novel from 1897 on stage, on screen, comedy, opera, ballet, every other, you know, element of entertainment, as well as costumes and role-playing games and video games and so on. So I feel in that regard, Bram's creation far outshines him and makes it fairly easy to forget Bram Stoker. You might remember the name because it gets put on things occasionally, you know, based on the book by, or based loosely on this book by.
Right.
Now, of course, the novel's in public domain and went there in 62. So it's like it can be published by anybody without paying my cousins. There are two great, my cousins, two of Bram's great-grandsons are still alive. They haven't received any royalties since 1962. So it gets out there, and people don't have to follow the rabbit hole to who was Bram Stoker and what exactly went into his writing of the novel. But what's interesting is there are a few dedicated scholars and fanatics that don't let this get away, because there's almost, Tim, a bit of a competition amongst 20 people worldwide to find out things that other people didn't know about. Find that little piece. And as they do, that brings Bram back into the forefront. And when that does, what happens to me, I can be only credited with about 1.5 discoveries of all these discoveries, right? And I'll tell you what they are in a moment. Sure. And they are featured in the documentary that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But my unique position, being a family member and being really the only one in the Stoker family that has kind of devoted the last 15 years of their life to doing this, and I do have the blessing of the family and the cousins to do this stuff. They supply me with all kinds of information, so on. But because I'm in this position, I'm able to, and I recognize all the other contributors, be the guy in the middle of the ring that takes this little bit from one place, takes a little discovery here and go, oh, wait a sec, this now has new meaning because we just discovered this. In by itself, this notebook sitting in the Rosenbach Museum is really cool. Mm-hmm. But not until Hans de Roos, a buddy of mine, found these map coordinates and inverted them and figured out what they meant. Oh, my God. That leads to this place in Transylvania in the mountains. I then looked at the typescript of Dracula that the Paul Allen estate owns and found that the original ending had a volcanic eruption. And guess what? The map coordinates lead you to an extinct volcano in northern Transylvania. So, oh, now this has new meaning. This is all good reason. And then somebody else finds these books in the London Library. I go over there to check on them, and Bram Stoker's made all these little notes and marks on these pages. Oh, my God, one of them is a book by Charles Bonner that has what? A sketch of Bran Castle, the only castle in any of the books that Bram was looking at. There was one other castle sketched by Elizabeth Mazzucchelli, an Italian lady. It was also Bran Castle. So the only sketches Bram had for his description of the exterior of his fictional castle are 400 miles away from the location where he put it.
Oh, wow.
And then I go to Scotland, because a buddy of mine, Mike Shepherd, has done all kinds of research up there, and he introduces me to Slane's Castle, which happens to have, Tim, a very unique floor plan with an octagonal room in it, exactly the same way as Bram Stoker described Jonathan Harker's arrival into the fictional Castle Dracula in Chapter 2. I am convinced it's the same way Bram Stoker walked into Slane's Castle to visit the Earl of Errol back in 1893. So all of these mergers and through collecting pieces of a big puzzle, that's what I do. And that's what I'll be sharing with people about where these things came from, who are some of the other guys that made these discoveries, but most importantly, what really made Bram Stoker tick and what went into the research and writing of this novel that's been adapted, you know, hundreds of ways into film and TV and so on and so forth.
So as you're putting these pieces together, does it feel a little eerie to you that you're walking in these footsteps as you're putting the pieces together? And do you feel like maybe you're living vicariously through him and maybe living that life as you're doing it?
Now, that's the paranormal you coming out, isn't it? And that's cool because, no, I do. I mean, look, I have an open mind about spiritualism, as did Bram Stoker. I had one or two episodes, one of them in Marsh's Library, which is a haunted library established in the 1500s in Dublin, Ireland. So I think I had an episode, and so therefore I'm pretty open-minded about this stuff. So when I do these deep dives into my great-granduncle, and I do them in interesting places around the world, I don't go seek out a spooky place to open up an old book, but it just happens that way. Like when I was asked to come to London to look at all these books, you know, there was a very, very modern part of the library, but there was also, you know, really cool old parts. And by sitting in the desk that they say, that's where your great granduncle did his research, these are the books. These are the exact same books that he looked at. And here's the pencil marks on the page that he made. I did. I mean, I had some, who knows if I brought this on myself or the feeling was there, but I do feel a presence that he's wanting me somehow or urging me somehow to tell his story. And you know, it might sound corny to some and others get it, but Bram Stoker, I found through another person, I didn't discover them. I found that they existed. A young lady, God, I think she was in Iowa, did some research on Bram Stoker's interest in spiritualism and found 30 letters in Leeds, England, to known experts at the time in spiritualism before and after he wrote Dracula. So he shared that interest. And I then dug deeper into who those people were and looked into them, found some letters, other letters between Bram and so on. And then I found a newspaper article, Tim, in Dundee, Scotland, that actually recounted this journalist sitting in a social gathering where Bram Stoker was present. And he said, I first went there to meet Henry Irving, and I found Mr. Stoker much more interesting as he was regaling us in two of his own experiences in people with second sight, premonitions, we call them.
Okay.
And so I have really come to believe that Bram was open-minded. Oh, by the way, I found a book in Bram's library that he did, the one and only book review that anyone's ever found that Bram Stoker reviewed. It was a book by a Scottish guy, and it was printed in a newspaper in New Zealand, but it was about second sight and premonitions of the Highlands of Scotland. And that's where Bram actually wrote Dracula in Scotland, in Cruden Bay, Scotland. So he made his own connections. But yeah, I mean, I've gone off on a tangent, but you get it. I think the Stokers are open-minded people about these things. Bram did it probably more privately, because back in those days, it was a little risky, especially for an upstanding conservative theater manager to be, you know, one of these forward thinkers. He was a Freemason.
Yeah.
He attended meetings. We don't think he was a member of the Order of the Golden Dawn, but he certainly frequented with many of the members who were. So interesting guy, and I want to paint a picture of what he was like and you know, what he has made me feel like as I've been embarking on a 15-year odyssey to figure him out.
That is incredibly interesting. It does make you wonder, and I guess the mind wanders a bit when you think, okay, so he went to Scotland, and of course when he's in Scotland, is he? I mean, of course, being a member of the Freemasons, he's probably he's probably visiting different lodges and whatnot, and he's probably doing other things when it comes to meetings and whatnot, and exploring things there. But is he at that time tying in? If you're mentioning it, again, follow me on my line of thinking here,
yeah,
Dacre.
Sure.
If he does possess a novel that has to do with Second Sight from Scotland, is he following some of the things that's in that novel? In other words, if he's studying and he's keeping it quiet, is he actually maybe following up on some of that study? And is he maybe secretly, as he's getting inspiration in writing, is he learning a little bit more at the same time that he's writing? Are you following what I'm saying?
Oh, only too well. Oh my God, where are we going to go with this? Because I've got an unpublished work that's out there right now. It's being looked at, and I'm not going to jinx it, by a publisher in a country that really loved Dracul, and it was a bestseller there.
Mm-hmm.
And what you just said, Tim, could be the blurb of that novel. I wrote it with Dr. Leverett Butts, a professor from the University of North Georgia. We both focused in on very similar material. The summer Bram wrote Dracula while staying at the Kilmarnock Arms Hotel in Cruden Bay, which is true, but all the weird things that happened to him, and many of them were as a result of his second sight, his relationship with other people, interesting, and let's just say interesting, deep thinkers in that area, mm-hmm. of which Mike Shepherd has helped me find the names of these people and who they were and a little bit about them, and how he was affected with this second sight, writing this novel and needing to get this novel off his chest and out there as a warning to the world that possibly he knew something about vampires that others did not, and he needed to warn people. So he writes the novel Dracula after compiling notes, which is true now, for 7 years, actually 6 years, he compiled the notes and wrote it the end of the 6th year, and it finally, the thing came out in the 7th year. So he started 1890, came out in 1897, and I know exactly where he was every summer when he did his writing, because of the notes and his journal and cross-referencing the guest books and all these places where he was. But I mean, we could go on and on about it, but I think what it does is it gives people with an interest in the paranormal a reason to really look into not only Bram Stoker's Dracula, but the novel that I think is his second best, that was also written up there in Cruden Bay, The Mystery of the Sea, which starts with a chapter that he released early called The Seer. So there is a character in that story called Gormala, Highland Scottish lady that comes down to Cruden Bay, which is not too far. It's only about 45 minutes north of Aberdeen. So it's not way, way up there, the Isle of Skye and all that. So why you made me pause, Tim, when you said that is, it's, oh my God, you know, what does Tim know about this? Tim's going to have to read Mystery to see at some point. Now, any of the listeners, if you want to read any of Bram Stoker's works for free, go to bramstoker.org. It's a free site set up by a university professor. rightfully so. It's all public domain stuff. Go check out The Seer in the short story section. It then became the early chapter one and two, I believe, of The Mystery of the Sea, which is worth it to write. I'm actually trying to nudge my son, who's doing his PhD in English literature, and as soon as he's finished with Walt Whitman and the rest, he is going to look into an abridged. I want him to pick up the mantle for me and do an annotated, abridged edition of Mystery of the Sea. So there we go. Let's just put that in a box and move on.
Sure.
Cool stuff.
Very cool, especially for an audience that's into the paranormal. The fact that Bram went down that road. Very interesting indeed. All right. We'll box that up and we'll leave that where it is, and then we'll continue with Dracula here. But I tell you what, that's actually a good point for us to jump off and take our break. But when we come back, we'll talk about The Assembly and how Father of Dracula came about, the new documentary film that Dacre is putting together with Irish filmmaker Jason Figgis. It's being written by John West. We're also going to tell you how you can get involved and help with this movie through Indiegogo. We also have a link in the description of this program where you can get involved. You can click on that link and you can help monetarily to get this thing moving, because we want to get this thing released, of course. So there's a timeline, of course, as well, folks. This isn't an open-ended thing. There's some urgency to this. So we're encouraging you, as soon as you hear this podcast, to help and to put your money where your mouth is. If you want to see this movie get off the ground, this life story of the father of Dracula, Bram Stoker, just click on that link and help out, please. Go to Indiegogo and contribute. When we come back, we're going to find out more about Father of Dracula, the inspiration for it, and how you can help. Right after this on the Best in Paranormal Podcasting, this is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Our guest is Dacre Stoker. He is the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker, who, of course, is the quote-unquote father of Dracula, which is also the name of the new documentary film that's being put together by Dacre Stoker and two of his colleagues, Irish filmmaker Jason Figgis. It's being written by John West. Now, Dacre, tell us a little bit, or take us through the process of how this documentary film came together.
Well, yeah, it's been about 10 years in the making. You know, nothing just goes easy. I met Jason Figgis at a film festival outside Dublin, Ireland, in Dunlowry. He was putting on a film at this underground film festival, and I thought it was pretty cool. I was presenting Dracula. You know, we basically had a beer together and said, you know, one day we've got to work together, like everybody does. When I like his work, he likes my work. Yeah, we got to work together someday. And it just, you know, slowly I'd come back over to Dublin, Ireland to do the Bram Stoker Festival, usually almost every second Halloween. And I'd, you know, we'd have a beer together. We'd chat. How's it going? How are we going to do this? And it was like, okay, let's pitch this. Let's pitch it here. We've got some feelers here. So for all you listeners, there's a number of ways. When you do one of these films, is you put together a pitch, you got to get all your resource material. You've put no money into it, no filming, nothing, just really good ideas, and you want to have a good pedigree of people involved. And, you know, we tried that, and we got really close a couple of times, never went anywhere. And then COVID came along, and Jason said, look, I got this buddy, John West, who, funnily enough, is very well known in paranormal circles in England. And has written some books about hauntings of certain places. So if you're into British paranormal, check out John West. That's one of his cool things. And also something that when we all compared notes, a photographer, Sir Simon Marsden, was really into taking still photos of sort of the paranormal in Victorian times. And so he is a guy that Jason did a biography of. So I thought, I like this approach, very dark, very gritty. let's try to do this someday. And you know, during COVID, he said, look, nobody was commissioning anything. He couldn't work. Mm-hmm. So I just decided to do things with existing footage and do it really on the cheap. So, Dacre, what do you think about doing Father of Dracula this way? And I said, well, you know, I'm ahead of you a little bit because all my trips that I take, and I now lead people on tours to Cruden Bay, Scotland, where Bram wrote Dracula, Whitby, England, where he got inspired on a three-week holiday for many elements of Dracula, Dublin, and parts around Dublin where Bram did his schooling, he did his work, and so on and so forth. So that's the three main pieces. Then, of course, Transylvania, where I take people on tours. And a friend of mine, Colin Hamilton, is a former Sky TV embedded videographer in different wars all over the world. He's got sick and tired of having bullets flying over his head. And he's retired and now freelance. He's got a passion, being a former Northern Irelander of Bram Stoker, that he comes along with me on his own expense. Sometimes we bunk up and share rooms together, you know, all this. Mm-hmm. And he shoots video wherever we go, and little interviews wherever we go, either with, you know, me standing in front of significant places, inside castles, torture chambers, all that kind of cool stuff. Or, you know, we meet somebody and say, can we interview you quickly, who's a, you know, a good talking head that would add to something at some point. So when Figgis came along and said, look, I got this John West. He's got a good pedigree of writing in the paranormal. Let's pull him in. Dacre, funnel him all your ideas. He can put the thing together in a script. You've already got a lot of the footage, so let's take all that. He found a young lady in one of his other films who would do sort of these spot, like female pieces, either Mina or Bram Stoker's mother or his sister. So she was able to do things. So we put together all this footage. We put together, 150 still shots that I've collected over the years, some of Bram's notes, some of the typescript, some of the locations. And he's got them all. And what we're now waiting for, and actually, John West did an excellent script along with all of my research. I then did the narration, sitting where I'm sitting right now with a really good microphone and so on. So what we're waiting for and the money we need to raise is about $30,000. So we can get Jason into a really good studio with incredibly good editing material. Mm-hmm. So all the stuff that we've done out of our pocket, all of our flights and everything out of our pockets, this is where we finally need the money to edit the whole thing and put it together with music and special effects and so on. And that's what we're looking for. You know, it's like if we can get it done this way with all your help and everybody else's help to pitch in, then there's a really good chance this will get, you know, picked up. We'll have them at film festivals, at horror festivals, at different conventions. Maybe then it'll get picked up by a streaming service or by Discovery or History Channel, somebody like that. Because, like, who wouldn't want to know the inside secrets of Bram Stoker, you know, as told through, you know, 15 years of research, as I said, coding the pieces of the puzzle together.
Well, and there's a rich history there of Bram Stoker as well. It's in some amazing stuff that happened in the life of Bram Stoker. It's not like, you know, he just, you know, sat around playing cards and then decided to come up with a character. It's not it wasn't a mundane life that Bram Stoker led, living up until the time where he wrote these novels. Just a little bit that we pointed out so far in the program is intriguing.
There's a number of things. I mean, look, he wasn't supposed to live. He was an invalid for the first 7 years. He was told all kinds of bizarre stories. One of them I know for a fact, and I've seen it written down, is about his mother telling him about the cholera epidemic, where she witnessed misdiagnosis and premature burial and people crawling out of mass graves. I mean, imagine what that does to a kid, you know, when he himself is sickly and most likely being bloodlet by his uncle, Edward Alexander, you know, who was a specialist in dealing with fevers, which is all these weird illnesses. A very conflicted man as well. You know, he was the only one in the family, not a scientist or a civil servant. You know, mm-hmm. he followed his passion like people do to these days, as a writer and a theater manager and an artist, you know, and he was a very upstanding guy. He was the first, he was responsible as the acting manager and theater manager for Henry Irving, who became the first actor ever knighted. So not only were they super creative, but they balanced the books. They made everybody do all their lines correctly, proper costumes, proper set design. He revolutionized the stage, Irving and Stoker did. So that's the type of guy that he was. And he did very meticulous research in Dracula to the point where, you know, if you don't really know the novel that well, realize this, it scared the bejesus out of people in the late 1800s when it came out in 1897, because he wrote it in the epistolary style and he had a way of making the story seem real. And people knew about vampires at this stage. They were very aware of these vampire scares in Eastern Europe, more aware of the vampire scare in this country, in New England states, which were actually clipped out of a newspaper and stuck in Bram's notes. So he simply turned this sort of a hysteria into a well-written novel, and this count, mysterious country of Transylvania, arriving into England and beginning to, you know, expand his flock, so to speak.
I know it's just conjecture here, Dacre, but do you suppose it's because life started out so dark for him that it was so easy for him to reach back into that darkness and pull it forward and use it in his writing? Or do you think it was just a short trip for him to reach into that darkness and pull it forward? Or do you think it took quite the imagination and he always had that imagination?
Well, it's a great question, Tim. To start with, he was Irish, and many Irish are good storytellers. Mm-hmm. And they're all, many of them have the ability to tell the most darkest, dreary, you know, horrible stories about the misery of what they've gone through and this poor country. And they've gone through potato famines and cholera epidemics and mass exodus and so on. But Bram, it was not also unusual to him to witness these kind of horrors. He traveled around the country as the inspector of all clerks of petty sessions. So he, like Harker, traveled in a carriage, traveled in trains, saw what was going on, picked up all kinds of stories and superstition and folklore from Ireland. And guys, he didn't write just Dracula. He wrote 12 other novels. Mm-hmm. And three quarters of them are all these kind of, you know, super, have supernatural elements to them if they're not altogether supernatural. You know, that sort of dark side of where weird things can happen, but stemming from reality. They weren't totally fanciful. You know, he wrote Jewel of Seven Stars, which is, you know, a mummy being found. Well, if you look at the time when this was discovered, people were really wondering about, you know, the supernatural elements of mummies that are being taken out of these tombs in Egypt and so on. So he was spot on when it comes to the relevancy of his material, in the same way, Tim, as he was spot on in the Lyceum Theater to adjust plays to make them strike a nerve with his audiences. So this guy was on it. He knew what it was needed, and he did all the necessary research to make sure that he was using sources that were credible and that would give him sort of a leg up to complement his imagination.
One of the interesting facts out there that you plan on bringing up in the documentary is that Bram was friends with William and Oscar Wilde. And I find that an interesting literary tie as well. You talk about the different literary, I guess, influences that you can pull from in the different places where you get inspiration from, but you talk about just hanging around different friends or having different friends and how some of that could rub off on you. Can you talk a little bit about that relationship?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, you know, the world was a smaller place and the literary intelligentsia were a tight community in Dublin, Ireland. And there was a lot of pressure in Dublin, Ireland at the time, obviously, first of all, between Catholics and Protestants, and then also it was a very conservative social network where freedom you know, sort of straying from the way of whatever religion you followed was not done. And of course, Oster did that with his flamboyancy, with his sexuality. William Wilde was not that way at all. And the father, Dr. William Wilde, was a bit of a scallywag and, you know, had affairs with some of his patients and was brought to court. But all I know really about Oscar Wilde is, of course, he dated Florence Balcombe, who Bram ended up marrying. So, you know, it's not like he stole her away. She made the choice and found Bram a much better option. And I think that was partly because Bram got this job to go off to London, to leave Dublin. And that, you know, she had her eyes set on the social side of Dublin and also potentially, London, and also potentially an acting career. So that was her sort of impetus. And William Wilde was a classmate of Bram's in the Philosophical Society. But the closest Wilde connection, Tim, is an interesting one. It's Lady Jane Wilde. She was a writer. She was a poet. And she wrote of Irish superstition and folklore.
Hmm.
One of the books in Bram's own library that I discovered was a book by Lady Jane Wilde that I now use in my Stoker on Stoker presentations, which actually mentions the similarities between Irish superstition and folklore and that of Transylvania, which both included vampires.
Really?
And Madame Girard has just written an essay on it in Transylvanian Superstitions. I am sure that's the source that directed my great-granduncle to find the essay called Transylvanian Superstitions by Scottish author Emily Girard, who was living in Sibiu, northern Transylvania, and was enamored, as she was back when she was living in Scotland, with superstition and folklore, and provided Bram Stoker in that essay, and then it got published in Land Beyond the Forest, a two-volume book, all about the same stuff, all the information he needed about Spitigoi Nosferatu, which, of course, was vampire, mm-hmm. and how they're created and how you kill them. So it's a contribution that comes from, you know, the friendship with the former boyfriend of his wife, from the classmate Willie, and the mentorship that I have discovered that Lady Jane Wilde did. Bram's father was not really keen on him going to the theater and taking that job and also becoming a writer rather than sticking with his job as a civil servant. But she was very supportive of Bram, and hence that's why I think he ended up with that book in his library, and that's what directed him to find all this cool information by Emily Girard and so on in Transylvania.
Boy, it's a small world, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is.
Speaking of being a small world, the other person he gets to know along the way is Buffalo Bill Cody.
isn't that bizarre?
Yeah.
But again, when you think about this, if you know, not many people know that Bram and Irving and, you know, 80 other people from the Lyceum Theater, set designers, costume carriers, and all this other stuff, came to America 8 times when they would close down the Lyceum Theater and perform. I've actually found one of the maps that Bram drew on all the train lines across the whole country and back, mirroring his tours, showing where the train stops were and so on. Well, on one of these tours, they met the famous showman himself, Buffalo Bill Cody. And they saw him at some of their stops. And it was like paralleling this great American showman. When you got these great British showmen coming along, they were all sort of in the biz together. And on one of their visits, which started and stopped in New York, Buffalo Bill was playing, I think it was in Coney Island, and they kind of struck up a really good friendship. And Stoker and Irving paved the way for Buffalo Bill and his whole troop, horses and Indians and everybody, to get on a ship, you know, months later and sail over to England, perform in England, in Glasgow, in Edinburgh. There's a newspaper article I found about Buffalo Bill and one of the Indian chiefs, Irving and Stoker, in a carriage going through Hyde Park.
Jeez.
You know, just so this is the type of guy Irving was. He loved attention. He was a showman himself, and he recognized that in Buffalo Bill. But also Bram loved the freedom and that brashness that comes with America, that ability to write what you want to write, do it the way you want to do it, because none of the constraints like the tight Irish and British society. So guess what Bram did? He used the attributes of Buffalo Bill Cody to create three of his characters. So who's the one, the obvious one, Tim, in Dracula that would be a sort of a clone of Buffalo Bill Cody?
Think
the American.
Well, yeah, of course the American, that would have been
Starts with a Q.
Quincy Morris, right?
Quincy Morris.
Right.
So all these attributes of the gunslinging, the slang talking, Quincy Morris, that's Buffalo Bill. And then there's two other stories. One that actually Chris McCauley and I, we might have talked about it on your last show. We adapted a short story called The Squaw and turned it into The Virgin's Embrace for politically correct reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And the character in that, a brash American who shows up in Nuremberg to go see the torture chamber, and sure enough, there is a British couple, it's really Bram Stoker and Florence on their honeymoon, meet up with them and go through some weird things that happen. His name is Elias Hutchison. That's Buffalo Bill.
Hmm.
And then a rather unfortunately named character in Shoulder of Shasta, a novel about a British lady, high society, that has to leave the British Isles because of her respiratory allergies and asthma, which, folks, is Bram Stoker's problem, one of them, comes to America and takes up residence in California because the climate is drier, much better. And who does she bump into but an outdoorsman by the name of Grizzly Dick, which is also modeled after Buffalo Bill Cody. So, yeah, that's one of them. But it's that Americanism, that newness, that toughness that Bram really thought was, you know, pretty cool. And I want some of that in my stories.
Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. You know, and it's tidbits like this that you know, you put together in this movie. And really, when you think about it, again, we were talking about legacy in the beginning of the program. We're talking about how to keep a legacy alive. And when you think of the name Bram Stoker and people just say, oh yeah, Dracula. And they put Dracula before Bram Stoker. Really, Bram Stoker had this amazing life and he deserves a spotlight all his own to be put out there.
Well, I mean, he does. And I think, as you just said, how is his legacy then, you know, sort of highlighted? It's also connecting people like Buffalo Bill Cody, mm-hmm. like Mark Twain. You know, Mark Twain was the neighbor of Bram's in Chelsea. And Mark Twain actually has a line in Dracula. And Bram was helped him sell one of his books as an agent. And Mark Twain had this great line in Round the Equator, is faith is knowing what you know ain't so. Right? Mm-hmm. So in Dracula, Bram says, I once knew this American who said, faith is believing things you know to be untrue. He just changed the words a little bit when he's talking about believing in things you don't know, that you can't prove. That's where Van Helsing's trying to make Jack Seward, the scientist, the doctor. He's got to understand why this blood is leaving Lucy and no piles of blood every morning on the floor. They give her a transfusion at night and there's no blood in her body and there's none on the floor. Where is it going? And Van Helsing is not going to say, it's a vampire, you idiot. He's trying to get them to open their mind and believe in things they cannot prove. Faith is believing in things you know to be untrue. That's Mark Twain. So that's another connection, Tim, for Bram's life, a good friend. And I've seen plenty of letters back and forth between them where Mark Twain actually quoted Bram Stoker in a speech he gave at the commencement of New York University one year at their commencement operations.
That's amazing. And like you said, those were, I mean, it was amazing little, and that's not even synchronicities. Those are just amazing things that happen in the life of Bram Stoker that, again, mind-blowing things that are part of the fabric of the life of Bram Stoker that need to be put out there. And the way we consume things these days, Dacre, are visually. I mean, it's one thing to put it in a book. It's another to put it out there visually in a feature film or in a documentary where people can say, you know what? The guy who wrote Dracula, coolest guy ever. Here's why. And the way we retain it is we do retain it through watching it through movies. We really do. We really are a visual society now. You look at the way we consume things. We really do consume things through podcasts, through documentaries, through movies. That's the way we're consuming things. And so the reason I say this, folks, is we want to get this thing up and off the ground. And the way we do it is through you and through your help, like Dacre had said. And the way to do it is we have a link in the description of this program for you to click on. It's to contribute through Indiegogo. You can contribute, and it's a 60-day crowdsourcing campaign. Is that right, Dacre?
Yeah. It ends the end of June, so it opens here. It's April, May, and June. There's lots of cool little rewards along the way. And look, you can give $10. You know, that'd be great. You can be give $1,000 and you get a producer credit and you get a copy of the films and everything in between. So look, if you like the idea and like the kind of stuff you've heard tonight, you know, I really appreciate if you give anything also just to show some support, because for the past 5 years, you know, we all, between West and Stoker and Figgis and Colin Hamilton, have been shelling out bucks to get this to the point where it is. We just, you know, need a little help to get over the finish line to make a really cool product.
Absolutely. Just a couple more things before we wrap up tonight. There's, when we talk about the actual fabric of Dracula, there's a couple of facts out there that are absolutely amazing that are in the fabric of this film that people may find interesting. Let's talk about the Vlad the Impaler myth, if you will, and where that comes into it. How is it that there's a common misconception, or maybe it's a conception, of how Bram wove Vlad the Impaler in with Dracula. Can you clear that up for some people?
Yeah, I can, because I've spent a lot of energy on it. I've been to Transylvania now 14 times, and you know, I sit in front of some of the guys and say, what has your relative done? Turned one of our heroes into a Hollywood icon, and he's a vampire, blah, blah, blah. I said, no, wait a sec. Let's look at the facts. So I start, Tim, with outlining the facts of the whole thing. Number one, he read two books, and he read 27 books as far as we know, because he listed them at the end of his notes, like you would if you're writing a paper for a professor.
Sure.
Two books. One he saw by William Wilkinson, The Accounts of Principalities of Wallachia and Moldavia. So Vlad Dracula was the Prince of Wallachia, which is the southern province in Transylvania. Of Romania. Transylvania is just above it. So Bram actually looked at this book and saw that the name Dracula means devil. So that was the first link that I believe was made. And then another book by James Samuelson in the London Library also linked Vlad Dracula to being such an atrocious and violent leader that he's earned the nickname the Devil. So these two connections, Vlad the Impaler to the Devil for the way he acted and impaled people and so on, was enough to really get Bram's attention. He was looking for a devil incarnate. This was the occult that was pushing through and very, sort of prominent in Victorian societies, this interest in the other, as science was beginning to overtake religion as the final word in the way life and death was. Science was having to sort of open up the door to what else is out there, spiritualism, mesmerism, phrenology, all these other sort of fringe type things that people began to think of as religion lost their tight hold on everybody. It's God's way. Don't ask any questions. Now we're beginning to be much more inquisitive. So this whole process made Bram decide that the devil, the prince of darkness, needs to be the central character in the story. So he's now got two sources linking Dracula to the devil. He then goes and reads more, because when I have cross-referenced the Samuelson book, not the Wilkinson book, but the Samuelson book has all that backstory information that you see in Dracula, where he says, you know, I am of the Sestli blood, and this blood of Attila flows through my veins, and these berserkers have come from Iceland and come down here. This is what was going on during Vlad's time. So Bram was needing a real person who had this reputation of being a devil with a really good appropriate backstory to package, move him from Wallachia to Transylvania, no big deal. Mm-hmm. You know, that was not a problem. Bram did that with all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So that's him packaging something to make it realistic. And that's how we end up with Count Dracula. Bram never used the word Vlad in the whole novel. I never used the word Impaler, but he certainly knew where it all came from. So what's interesting is Bram was opportunistic and pieced together certain things, just like I said earlier in the show about the castle Dracula being merged together with Slane's and Bran and put over him. He did the same with his Vlad. Now, I enjoy going to literary festivals, film festivals, paranormal conventions, and chatting with people all about the films, because what you can look at is where this type of discussion is centered is really on the films. The Jack Palance film did more to establish early on the link between Vlad Dracula and Count Dracula. The 92 Coppola film, the first 2 or 3 minutes, Jim Hart, Coppola, established that connection between Vlad the Impaler and how he got turned into Dracula. Dracula Untold with Luke Evans is a whole movie on how Vlad Dracula sacrifices himself to become a vampire to protect himself against the invading Ottomans. So does Bram get credit for it, or does he get blamed for it? Who knows? It's a matter of perspective, Tim. But he was fairly vague about it, but he made the connection enough so that for the last 127 years, everybody has believed that Vlad the Impaler, Vlad Dracula III, is the guy that Bram as modeled for his Count Dracula. And, you know, it sticks. You know, there is evidence in the novel that Bram was planning to set the story in Austria until he read the book by Wilkinson in Whitby. So it could have been a different story. He was even planning to have the ship landing in Dover as opposed to Whitby. So many things changed because of these reading of these books. So a lot of the credit goes to his diligent research and the writing in the way that keeps people guessing and arguing about it again for over a century. That's what makes it cool to me.
Are these the same books that also he's pulling to get some of the more edgier occult aspects of Dracula as well?
Yes, absolutely. This is where he finds out about the connection between sleepwalking and trance walking and symbolism with demonic possession. It's all that, and you can see it in these books. Some of them are by learned men. Some are men of the cloth. But it's really interesting upon analysis, and that's what I talk about these things in this film.
Interesting.
About who wrote what, and why would a Church of England priest be talking about the other world and superstitions from beyond? You know, and I had a very interesting chat with a professor about that. He said, Dacre, as you know, the leaders of the church were losing their grip on their flock. Any smart leader begins to try to capitalize and understand the opposition. Yeah. So why not become an authority on the other now that you've already got everybody believing, you know, in God and Jesus and so on? you gotta, if they're now thinking of the other, you better get on that train and help them, you know, understand that as well, but do it on your terms. That's why these books were written.
That's very smart. And in fact, yeah, if you hold them up in the light and show them and then show exactly how dark they are and then turn it around and say, but I've got the answers to how to defeat them.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
You've got your flock and you've got the answer. And then they have to turn to you and be loyal to you. Yeah, the professor's absolutely nailed it on the head. That's yeah, but you have to show how deep and dark the enemy is and how dangerous they are, and then and what they can do, and fully expose them. But then you have to show how you have the key to defeat them. There's a whole psychology to it. It's very very interesting. It's very interesting how that whole thing breaks down. But I can imagine Bram had a field day with it. That's for sure.
I mean, can you? That's what I imagine as I did when I went into the London Library a few years ago, and the guy Philip Spedding showed me these books and showed me the marks and the margins. He's like, I can just imagine how Bram was so excited when he had these ideas based on his childhood stories, based on things that were already in his psyche, but now they're confirmed in writing by books. Written by upstanding members of the society, that now it's like, oh my God, there's a chapter on vampires and true ghosts and real things. And it's like, these people are going to love this book. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got them. You know, if I could just do it right.
Exactly. I think at this point we'll get people to, if they want to see the movie, we got to get it made, right? So at this point. I think we got to get people to help.
I think we've told them everything we can. I mean, the rest is up to you. Tim, you've been great, by the great questions and great listening skills as well, which is always appreciated. But it's there. And I got to echo what you said earlier. I've written a bunch of novels. I've written some short books about Stoker on Stoker, which is all about my lectures. I give the lectures, but I really want this thing in film. Because this is the way to go these days. If I can get this thing made and it gets out there, if it gets, even if it just makes it to film festivals and doesn't get picked up by streaming or whatever, I'm going to be so happy because I'll be able to go off to Northern Michigan and show it at Paracon and talk to everybody about it, do an interview with you after and before, whatever.
There you go.
So, please, folks, just consider it. It would be much appreciated.
The name of the film, again, Father of Dracula. It's being put together by Dacre Stoker, Jason Figgis, and it's written by John West. Again, folks, you have the power to put this thing together, and it's as simple as just contributing $10. Again, if you want a credit on the movie, you can contribute as much as $1,000. You can do it by going to Indiegogo, and we have a link in the description of this program, and it's real simple, folks. Just click on that link. It's in the description. And put your money where your mouth is. Let's get this thing made. Father of Dracula. And you'll be able to see it. As a matter of fact, we could push it all the way to a streamer. Let's put it on Netflix so that the entire world can see exactly how much influence Bram Stoker had, not just with Dracula, but on the literary community at large. Dacre Stoker, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Jim. Always good to be in the darkness with you, sir.
And it's our pleasure to have you here on Darkness Radio. I want to thank Dacre Stoker for being on the program once again. And the movie is Father of Dracula. And of course, it gets made with your help. So go click on that link to Indiegogo and give, if you can, $10. You can give us just as much as $10. By crowdsourcing, we're going to get this thing made. So if you feel so inclined to give just as little as $10, you can help get Father of Dracula made, and we'll get this thing made together. I'm telling you, folks, there is so much to learn about Bram Stoker, and we'll get it made together. That's the great thing about crowdsourcing these days and crowdsourcing some of these films. And you heard Dacre, it's practically made already. It's just $30,000 is what they're looking for to put this thing, the finishing touches on this thing, and just get the filmmakers into the editing bay to stitch it all together and basically give it a home, which is very little these days to put a movie to bed. It's a very small cost, and asking for your help, that's what they're looking for. So if you want to be able to help produce a Hollywood film and have your name put on it, by gosh, that's a very small feat, and a chance to invest in a worthy product. So give it a shot, man. Why not? Father of Dracula sounds really interesting. So again, click on the link, that Indiegogo link in the description of this program, to help out Father of Dracula and see it get made. Sounds like a cool opportunity. Coming into the weekend, it's time to remind people to be a light in someone's darkness. We are firmly in spring right now. You know, I get to sit down with Logan today, which is kind of cool. But right before we taped with Dacre today, and he got to dig into his seeds. He got a little less shy this week, which was kind of cool. I had my little chipmunk experience today. I saw Spud as well today, too. So the chippers are out and enjoying spring, and it's getting warmer outside. So I know what I'm doing this weekend. I don't have to be at KNSI. So I think I'll just be an old recluse and sit around with chipmunks this weekend. I don't know what you have planned, but hopefully you'll be using part of the weekend to help make someone's weekend a little bit brighter and a little bit cheerier, and making the world a little bit better for someone else this weekend. A little favor to your buddies here at Darkness Radio. Just a little request on our end. Let's see here. Another reminder. Two reminders, and then we're out of here, I swear. Check out the events page. DarknessRadioShow.com/events. Potographs for Pooches coming up May 18th at the Palmer House Hotel. Very, very few tickets left for this deal. In fact, as I say it, we may be out. I'm not quite sure. But we need you to, again, contribute to the animals at Eagle's Nest Shelter specifically. Let's sell this thing out, folks. Let's make the big push this weekend. Get your ticket for the event. Come on out, see myself, Richard Estep, Tim Miley, and let's do it for the animals. Let's sell this thing out, and let's go have a good time on May 18th at the Palmer House Hotel. I'm looking forward to seeing all your smiling faces out there, May 18th. And you know what? I'm gonna celebrate a little bit before I have foot surgery on the 22nd of May. So there you go. And then the last note I have before I leave you today would be to keep your eye on the shop at darknessradioshow.com. There's going to be some new items coming to the shop. Keep your eye out there, because we've got some new and exciting things at the shop that we want you to peruse and purchase. So there you go. There are going to be some exciting things too. Some neat things that you really like. So that's about it. So with that, go forward and enjoy your weekend. We've got some good stuff coming up next week for you, right here on the best in true crime and paranormal programming. You've been listening to Darkness Radio.